I'm Dave Knudsen, and I'm the village philosopher for this week and next. And tonight, we want to do a forum on the issue of rich nations, poor nations. What's the connection? Larry Rasmussen is going to do some presenting for a short while at the beginning of our time together. And then we'd like this to be a rather freewheeling discussion. We also want to include those who are prone in the balcony in the discussion. So feel free to chime in case those of you who are down here didn't know that. I guess this is a favorite hangout for people who would like to take it a little easier up on the balcony.
They're the rabble rousers.
Yeah, that's right. You all know Larry, of course, as the program director at Holden Village, but perhaps many of you don't know that he also teaches social ethics at Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. And he's been involved in writing books about ethics as well. Some of you are familiar, perhaps, with his book on Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Reality and Resistance. He's written a book, I know, on the Bible and ethics and the connections between those two. So, Larry.
Thank you, Dave. What I thought I would do is simply be descriptive for a few minutes about the distribution of certain crucial resources and other essentials, the distribution between rich nations and poor nations. this of necessity means an oversimplified sketch, but it has a way of giving us some kind of sense of the way in which the world is put together. I will say rich nations, poor nations. Roughly, that means industrialized nations as contrasted with what are usually called less developing or developing nations, which is another way of saying not rich industrialized nations. And roughly, it's a way of saying the nations of the North Atlantic and North Pacific in contrast with the Southern Hemisphere. So, Western Europe, North America, and Japan and Korea, and contrasted with Africa, Latin America, Southeast Asia. An exception to that is Australia, which would be regarded as among the nations of, in this case, the North. So when we talk about rich nations, poor nations, those are roughly the kinds of ties. I'll do two things. One, just share with you what I've put on the board here. And then secondly, share with you four theories, one paragraph each, on why developing nations are not developing in the way in which it was even expected they would in the heady days following World War II, and in the affluent years in the North of the 50s and 60s and into the 70s. So, the items on the board are as follows. The developing world, in other words, the poor nations, has 75% of the world's population. I put that figure in the top and drew a line under it because you must remember that figure of population compared then with the other items which are really have to do with the things that people need and use.
Does that include China?
Yes, that includes China. 75% of the world's population. The developing world has 15% of the world's energy consumption. And if you want to think as we go along about the converse of this, the rich industrial nations have 25% of the world's population, and as you go down, 85% of the world's energy consumption. The developing world has 17% of the world's gross product. That's a shorthand way of talking about the sum total of goods and services. When we usually say gross national product, world products. So 75% of the world's population has 17% of the world's gross product. The developing world has 30% of the world's food grains, 18% of the world's export earnings, 8% of the world's industry. If you want to think of the reverse of that, 25% of the world's population has then 92% of the world's industry. The developing world has 6% of world health expenditures, has 11% of the world's education spending, has 5% of the world's science and technology. Now, these figures are taken from a variety of sources, from U.S. government figures through the Agency of International Development, from United Nations development programs, and from a recently concluded major study on the relationship between North and South, usually called the Brandt Commission report. I added over on the side some other figures which are not usually included when we talk about the relationship of rich nations and poor nations, but which I don't think should be left out of the picture, namely military spending. The world spends about 20 times as much on military expenditures as it does on development aid. Presently, and this is a figure for this past year actually, the world is spending about $1 million per minute on military expenditures. That comes out to about $100 per person in the world per year. The exporters of military weapons are the United States exports 74% of the world's total, the USSR 27%, France 11%, and then there are some other countries, small figures. Now those do not add up to 100%, and the reason is that there are different ways of calculating what belongs to military expenditures. It still gives you some rough idea. It is, in short, rich nations exporting, and above all the United States, exporting arms to poor nations, which buy them, and you can see what that would tend to do within their domestic economy as far as priorities are concerned. And then one other figure that has to do with overall consumption of goods and resources. Something, and this is of course rough, but it still gives you some general picture, something in the way of 20 to 40 times the amount of goods and services are consumed by each person in the rich countries of the world compared with each person in the poor countries of the world. 20 to 40 times as much. I don't know what, you know, I don't know how exact people get on that, but it's again, a figure that comes from U.S. government, from the United Nations, and from the Brandt Report. They all vary somewhat, but they all fall within that range. Okay, then let me share for a few minutes four theories as to why poor nations have not met the expectations that were invested in them and that was and by the rich countries in the last three decades. Some say that the root problem is in what is often called economic neocolonialism that continued in poor countries after they gained their political independence. The theory goes like this: the less developed countries remain the source of cheap raw materials and cheap labor that are exploited to feed the high consumption habits of the rich industrial nations. The theory often says that large transnational corporations are the vehicles for, in effect, moving wealth from the poor to the rich, as well as between the rich countries themselves. Often there are politically and economically powerful people within the poor nations who benefit from these relationships between rich nations and poor nations. So you have, the theory goes, usually greater gaps between rich and poor in the poor nations than you do between rich and poor in the rich nations. And the rich in the poor nations are in positions of power, and their lifestyle is in fact tied to the arrangements with the rich nations. So they are part of what is in effect a neocolonialist structure. That's one theory. It's sometimes called dependency theory, or neocolonialism, economic neocolonialism. Another theory regards the problem in the lack of development in so many poor nations as essentially one of unequal opportunities, especially in international trade. The poor countries, while they're dependent on trade, lack any leverage for determining the prices of either the price they receive for their exports or the price they pay for needed imports. What a lot of poor countries export are natural resources, and what they want to import is often technology to develop their own nascent industry. They have had, the theory goes, very little to say about either the price that they will receive for their exports or the price they have to pay for what they do not produce themselves. I was in East Africa for a little while and did a little work here, and between 1970 and 1974, this is just an example, the average prices of East Africa's five major export commodities went up 34%. In that four-year period, they received 34% more for their exports in 1974 than they did in 1970. During the same period, the cost of their industrial imports went up 91%. So they lost something on the order of 60% between the increased price they got for exports and the increased price they paid. But the real point is that the East African countries did not have, like the rich countries did, the power to determine the prices of the poorer countries' exports and imports. So that's the second theory, unequal opportunities, especially in trade. The third view claims that the problem is a lack of capital and slow growth, slow economic growth in the developing nations, and a lack of investment, the lack of sort of getting started, getting to what Walter Rostow used to call, still calls, the takeoff stage. This, I might just add parenthetically, that while no one doubts that a certain amount of capital and certain high rate of economic growth is desirable and maybe even necessary for development, that theory in and of itself is subject to a lot of exceptions. There are many poor, relatively poor nations that have received a great deal of capital investment and experience high economic growth, but where the gap between rich and poor is increased instead of decreased. And Brazil is an example of a case where high economic growth did not do anything to resolve inequities in the distribution of income. The fourth view stresses cultural differences. This theory goes something like this. The cultural habits of poor nations are backward in the sense that they do not fit the requirements of modernization. What does that mean? That means the culture is not conducive to a planning and organizational mentality, is not conducive to a necessary drive to get ahead, to work hard and to save, but to defer gratification. The culture does not, in other words, show the presence of a work ethic, or does not show the willingness to live life by the clock, which an industrial society absolutely insists upon, or is not a culture that is highly receptive to modern science and technology, which is a whole way of looking at the world. It may be natural to us, not necessarily natural to lots of folks. If the requirements imposed by a technological and industrial society are not accepted, this theory goes, then poverty results, because the chief generator of wealth in the modern world is industrialization. And that has its own cultural stipulations. Well, these four theories aren't necessarily, well, they are not, exclusive of one another. I just put the four words up here to remind us of them. Economic neocolonialism, unequal opportunities, especially in trade, slow economic growth, and then fourth, cultural factors. But they are important insofar as if you decide that one or the other is the primary concern, then that means one or another response also goes along with that. If you say neocolonialism is the problem, then you say the solution is to get rid of that kind of dependency upon the rich nations. But and then you want to focus on the relationship between them. But if you say the cultural factors are the problems, then you have a different kind of solution. So, that quickly then is a kind of profile of the differences between rich nations and poor nations and four broad theories as to why developing nations have not developed. You want to just, I see some hands, Dave.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think they may be questions or clarification.
Do you have one more statistic between the developed and undeveloped nations? Percentage of natural resources, and in particular the percentage of potential energy sources in undeveloped countries.
That would be a handy one to have, which I don't have. Incidentally, these figures do not include OPEC nations, some of which are among the poor nations, but most of which are not now. In terms
both
of
Latin
per
America
capita.
And Africa had tremendous hydroelectric potentials.
Yeah,
well,
but they're non-developed. Reserve, they're non-developed,
I know.
Basically. Yeah.
Except
a lot, lots of, we need to do lots of qualifications. Africa is enormously rich in terms of natural resources of many kinds, but most of it has been as yet unexploited. And part of the discussion needs to ask how that, in fact, the exploitation of those resources happens. Who does it? Who has the power and capability, education, etc., to do that? I don't have any general figures as to the location of those.
But stability of the political system within the various countries, does that fall into your first category?
You mean on which category?
Neocolonialism, political stability or lack of stability? It seems, at least from my small knowledge, that the majority of the undeveloped countries are very unstable politically.
Yeah.
And that their governments are oppressive or incapable of management. All I know is what I read in the newspaper, Time Magazine, and the television. But they, you know, your Idi Amin's are there, and your various different political problems, Brazil and the Banana Republics, and
yes,
go down the line, and they all seem to, you know, to go from one dictator to another.
Yeah.
And does that fit into any of the categories,
well,
or have any?
Certainly, in Central America and South America, dependency theory, this economic neocolonialism, often sees a rich elite,
mm-hmm.
often have made up of business families and landlords.
No, this is Somoza.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and as their life really tied to the arrangements between rich nations and poor nations. You know, whether it's cash crops like bananas or coffee for a public which is not within the country but outside the country, the United States or Europe or whatever.
There's a tremendously high population birth rate is that a factor?
Yes, that is slowing. In fact, it's slowing now much faster than anyone expected. Even a half dozen years ago, The overall world birth rate now has fallen just below 2%. However, in some developing nations, and especially in Africa, it's still very high. It's often up to 3. In East Africa, it's about 3.8%. And so the expectation is that by 2000, we're still talking about adding another 2 billion people to the planet, which now has about 4.25 billion. So you're talking about a third more. What I think it's important for us to realize, however, or what's important for us to ask is, what is the significance of more people? If you talk about increased population with members of a lot of third world nations, they will say, what is significant is not the number of persons, it is the consumption per person. What are the demands of more people on the earth in terms of use of food, energy, shelter, etc.? And at that point, they point to this statistic that I shared earlier. People in the rich countries use goods and resources in factors 10, 20, 30, 40 times those in poor countries. So by their reckoning, we're the overpopulated nation.
The poor people, of course, are unable to purchase this kind of thing.
Yeah.
Now China is doing something about it, recognizing this problem.
Yeah. China has a very strict birth control policy. It's maybe the strictest in the world.
The other countries, because of their particular culture, the emphasis on large families.
Yeah.
Very difficult.
Yeah, in Tanzania where we were, there were economic rewards for having large families because land is still abundant, but there isn't any sophisticated technology, and they couldn't afford it right now if there was. So you, in order to grow more, you needed more. Folks, so it was all labor-intensive agriculture, and if you had more people to work the land, then you could raise more.
There's also their thinking is so much different from ours. When we were living in Botswana, we just returned from there in Africa, and we had a lady that helped us in the house, a maid, and that had been trained before by people who had her about 4 or 5 years, and she was really very smart. And she had never been married, but she had 3 children. And that's very common. I mean, there's no stigma attached to that. But she thought of her 3 children as her old age insurance.
Yes.
So she was a very smart and a lovely woman. And I said to her one day, you know, Bernadette, I wish that you'd get married. I said, you'd make someone a wonderful wife. You're so such a good cook and housekeeper, you're so smart and things like that. She said, no, she said, there'd be no advantage for me to get married. She said, I now have my 3 children that'll take care of me in my old age.
Yeah.
And she said, there'd be no advantage for me to get married. I would just have a man to take care of, she said. Which is true, because, I mean, there women are very valuable, and they do all the work. And wait on the man, make his beer every day, and all that stuff. And she better do it, because black women, that's the way it works. And she said, no, I don't need that. But that's the way, you see, they don't have anybody, even for the blind, they have no allotment for care for anybody, no social security.
And do the families take care?
Yes, they have been, but you see with this Western influence now coming in, that is hurting this very much. There's just one newspaper in Botswana, and I always read it if I can get a hold of it, free, and people line up for a couple of blocks, and they just last so long and then they're gone. But I always like to read the letters to the editor from the natives, because I like to think what they're thinking. See, I see what they're thinking. And that's one of the complaints that keeps coming in all the time. They say, now our young people are going to the cities.
Yeah.
And who's going to look after us? I'm blind, my wife is this or that, and can't you do something to make the young people stay home? See, of course, they want to go off to work. It's exciting. or the lakes are, they want to stay out there. And that's it. In that way, the Western influence has been very bad because it's broken up the family.
That's a very good point that you just brought up. I spent about 7 months traveling through the South Pacific and Southeast Asia last year through a number of underdeveloped countries. And, you know, in talking with a lot of the, particularly young, I'm 24, so in talking with a lot of people my own age or younger, just, you know, relatively young people, and particularly the ones that are educated in the universities, exactly the same thing is happening in Southeast Asia, which is probably one of the faster developing areas of the underdeveloped world that you're talking about. And it's like, you know, we talk about the decay of the moral fiber of Western culture. Well, the same thing is happening in some of these other places. And it's following the very same trend. I mean, you can just see it. And one of the problems that hit me as a Christian was what right do we have? Okay, it's up to us to help, to love our brothers and sisters, and to do the best we can. But is everything that we have so good? You know, and it's, sure, it's got its good points and bad points. But is it up to us to come in and give them all these great and wonderful things? You know, and because, shoot, after all, look what it's done for us. Isn't it neat? Well, when you start seeing some of these things, you begin to take a step back and think about everything. For an example, I was teaching English at a refugee camp in Thailand for a month. And all these people, their goal was to get to the United States, okay, so that the United States or Australia, so that they could settle and have a good life. Well, they will experience so many more hardships in the United States than they would just by staying there in the refugee camp. It's unbelievable. And, I certainly don't say that I express all kinds of wisdom, but it's such a big misconception about the advantages of Western culture and all the things that it can give to them. In some ways, it's very, very, it was very sad for me. I don't know. It's quite an impact on me.
The thing that surprised me too there was that the mental hospitals are overflowing. The hospitals are built for 100. The one that I know of has over 400 people in it, and they're just they just can't cope with this extreme change that they're trying to. It's just too much for them in such a short time.
I think, you know, this raises a good issue. On the one hand, we have enjoyed a certain standard of living, which has been rather bountiful, than the other industrialized countries have also. We recognize the limitations of that in a lot of different ways, spiritually, psychically, sociologically, so on. Breakdown of traditions, all kinds of things are connected with the process of industrialization. We recognize that there may be something that other poor nations have not gone through that we ought to learn from. Yet at the same time, I suppose we have to ask the question, we simply let them be as they are without aspirations for their own standard of living or the improvement of that. So where do we stand on something like that? How do we deal with that? And I sense from what you said, is it Eric?
Yes.
Yeah. I sense from what you said, you know, that you recognize the kind of vacuousness in your own system, you know, and recognizing that there's something there that they have not gone through, so in a sense they haven't experienced that same process. How do we relate to that? What is our attitude to be towards that? If they have aspirations towards that, are we to encourage that, help it develop, and so on, or what?
Hmm. I know. That was one thing. What are our current foreign aid policies right now? I'm really not up to date. What are they? I know some programs where we haven't done very good with the Nestle company, you know, this cola stuff, and they haven't had very much success. In fact, they have done more harm than good in those areas.
You know, I think that that was blown up all out of proportion, that Nestle thing. I just can't, well, I don't know about other African countries, but I know that that couldn't happen in Botswana. It just could not happen that this would these people would get a hold of all these Nestle samples and things. Because the Scandinavians especially have set up a wonderful health program in Botswana, the country of Botswana. And no matter where you go in that country, which is as large as Texas, and we were all over it, my husband and I, in the health field, they have set up marvelous clinics there that are manned by people that know what they're doing. And they're almost all the babies now are born in a clinic in Botswana. And those health workers in no way would give out any free samples to somebody that didn't know what to do.
But that was the Swedish organized thing, and I read about that too. They are to be known by having very good programs because they stay usually for 3 years in a country, which is the longest time than any other nation will put in for any kind of help, and they stay with the people and learn along with them on their sort of level what they want them to do. And I think that's an exception.
But to your, again, even though it's just very round figures, to your question about foreign aid, it needs to be clear that that is we're not talking about large figures. I mean, the highest percentage of the United States gross national product that went for foreign aid was 2%. And now we're down about 0.8, less than 1% of our gross national product goes for foreign aid. So we're not talking about major figures. That doesn't mean it's not important in such programs as you're talking about in countries, but foreign aid simply is not a solution because it has nothing of the dimension.
What about the private sector? There are other organizations. Where's the Peace Corps and all this forming? Does that exist still? And, or is it, does that go under foreign policy? Or is that from the private sector?
No, that particular one is a government one. But again, if you added all of those programs together, whether they were doing a good job or a poor job, you're still talking about something which is minuscule compared with the dimensions of requirements for development.
What about from the institution of churches?
Church World Service does a beautiful work everywhere, and I can vouch for that.
I think what I hear Larry saying is that it's not a question of wondering about the good, which is done here in foreign aid, private agencies, Peace Corps, and so on, all of those things. But that it's always, it ends up to be a very small part of the pie. They're piecemeal efforts, they achieve something, but the problem itself, if you're looking at the question of equity, of global-wide standard of living, is so huge that is, you know, it's hardly making a dent, even if we were doing 10% of the gross national product, or 15 or 20.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I presume that, you know, where we are right now, it would be extremely politically unpopular to try to do anything more than 1%.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the
dilemma. I have trouble realizing that we have such overflow and surplus in rain that sits someplace in Kansas in those silos and they don't know, you know, it's 3-4 years old. Why do we keep all that? And we sell rain to the Russian. Why can't it be given to the world kind of countries?
Do we have an economist in the crowd that can help us on that? My response to that would be that I understand that the international economic situation is a very complex and difficult one.
Exactly. I was just going to make the international economy is more, to use your phrase, complex and more interdependent than it has ever been, ever. And consequently, it makes the world political situation much more delicate, because every decision that somebody makes affects something over here. Okay, for example, when I was in Thailand, the big stink over there was was whether or not the United States, this was last August when the Khmer Rouge forces from Cambodia were making intrusions into Thailand. The big question was, well, who's going to come to Thailand's aid? Is it going to be China? Is it going to be the United States? You know, well, the United States and China can't really differ on who's going to come to the aid of Thailand. And that's just one example in that particular case of military might. But when it gets into the area of grain and all these other things, I guess I don't have any facts or anything, but just other to say, then it's so interdependent, the economies, you know, and manipulating the flow of labor and the flow of capital to keep things at a stable level so that they don't go crazy and we don't get 100% inflation. You know, we have to monitor the selling of grain, because if we have too much grain and put too much grain on the market, the price goes way down, the farmers go out of business. You know, so there's all kinds of considerations. And
I think that's true. I guess that everybody's intuition at this point would be to say, let's get rid of the surplus grain and get it into the hands of people who need it. You know, I don't think there'd be anybody who would disagree with that. The problem becomes, what's the method by which you achieve that, and what's the political solution?
Problem. One of the problems with that surplus grain is it belongs to somebody.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And in order to get it to ship overseas, you have to buy it from somebody, and they're not going to accept a low price. They'd sooner see it sit in a barn rather than to give it away. And right. I think this is one of the things that enters in. Mm-hmm.
The government buys it, of course, and that.
Well, they can only buy so much of it.
Yeah, but then that increases the inflation.
Sure.
Third, like you say, it is very complex.
You get two of them. Who ships?
Distribution.
Yeah. The United States doesn't have a merchant fleet to move it, even if it were all given away.
And then when it gets there, who's going to see to it that it's distributed where it belongs? That's another cost.
That's a very simple answer. The local hierarchy does that. In Nicaragua, during the major earthquake in 72, 73, the United States went in there with a tremendous amount of aid. The churches also went in there with a amount of aid. The churches got to the people. The American aid had to go through the diplomatic channels, which got into the local hands, the local politicians. They sold it to the starving natives.
Of course, there's another question of balance and their dependency. You know, if you ship them grain this year, then you know they maybe next year, you got to ship next year and the year after that. I'm not a Scandinavian, but I have watched some of the Scandinavian aid programs work, and I do think they probably get a tremendous amount of mileage out of the money they spend. Mm-hmm. And a lot of their work is like industry to industry. And I think we all agree that these people really need to do a lot of things with their agriculture. And the Scandinavians are doing a great job with that. They do come up with a breeding program, for example. They come in and they upgrade the cattle genetically. They make great strides, quick doing that. And then they try to integrate a fertilizer program. It's kind of a natural kind of system. And they do go in and they stay long enough to get the job done. It's really remarkable. I wish that everybody would kind of learn something from that.
But what you're saying is that when they're through, that the people can continue it.
Yes, they do.
The problem with coming in with a tremendous amount of...
I noticed the
unless
British,
it's emergency relief.
I noticed the British are kind of pattering some of their work now after the Scandinavians in some of those countries.
When I was visiting development projects under U.S. AID, United States Development Agency, I met a lot of former Peace Corps folks who were then signed up with AID, culturally very sensitive people, and who sincerely stepped or walked into a culture and learned the language as best they could in the short time they were there, worked hard. But so many of those development projects were just in shambles a couple of years after they left. And part of the problem was simply the fact that the contracts for USAID people ran 2 years. When they would get frustrated with the fact that the indigenous population didn't pick up and work on an American schedule, they would respond in the way that you and I would respond, well, let's get this thing done. And so they would finish it, and then they would go home, and then there wouldn't be the kind of maintenance, there wasn't the education passed on I mean, the Scandinavians are a far better example of how to do it. And it wasn't because the Americans were you know, mean-spirited folks. On the contrary, fine folks.
But I think you really need the pros to be there, Larry.
Pardon?
To some extent, or to a large extent, you really need the pros to work in this thing. So, for example, in agriculture, you need agricultural real heavyweights.
But you need them for a long time. The best development projects were done by people who decided to live in that country and stayed 15 and 20 years.
I don't know. Would American Indian be a little bit of an example of that? I mean, they talk about sort of all these projects that have been done, and finally somebody leaves it, and it goes back to about 2 years back where it was. Started from, culturally, they just probably couldn't handle it.
I think we just expect way too much too fast from these people that are really so recently starting to develop, I might say. I remember talking to a young man in Nigeria that said that he was the grandson of a great chief there in Nigeria. And he said that when his grandfather died and was buried, the buried 35 live people to go with him among his servants. Now that's just the grandfather of a young person. You think back of your grandfathers, and that's not very long ago. So, I mean, we can't expect those people to come in and be industrialized, you know, think in our terms. They just don't think that way. Anything. I found that out in 3 years.
What would you like?
The easy things.
I'd like to ask a question about the trade terms, the second theory brought up. It seems that the first obligation of what developed nations have is not to get in the way of, not to really put up barriers to their developing nations' development. If there are cultural barriers within their own country, I'm not so sure we have an obligation to worry about that. But we do have an obligation to make sure we're not encroaching there. The 34%, 90% ratio that you mentioned, the concept of 60% law, is that a function of just world demand?
No.
Sort of an accident of demand? Or how is it that the developed nations control the price of the developing nations' exports to keep it down to 34% and manage to control the price of their own exports to developing countries and put those at 91%? Increase those at 91% in your figures.
I can give you a response that's often articulated in the United Nations by members of developing nations, and I can give you the supreme example of Liechtenstein, which is of course very, very salient example. Liechtenstein at the end of World War II was a poor Alpine nation. One of the poorer countries, actually. Today it's next to Kuwait, the second highest per capita income in the world. Now, how did it manage that in 30 years, where some country in Africa did not,
or Latin America?
25,000. But yeah, we're not going to take this too seriously. But there is a point. There is a point to be made here. What's the point? Liechtenstein found its niche in an international system by tying itself to the Swiss economy, for one thing, becoming a legal residence for multinational corporations, developing industry which other people didn't have a monopoly on, or which there was still a market. The point here, Paul, is that money, wealth, is not made, for the most part, from the purchase of the raw materials themselves, but in the processing.
Even Gulf Oil now found itself lobbying in Washington against the Reagan administration's recognition of the present government in Angola, because Gulf Oil has worked out the terms in Angola of getting along with the Marxist government there, and it sounds like an extremely generous arrangement. Gulf said, we'll pump this oil out of Angola, we've got the technology to do it, you'll get the money for the oil. And that sounds crazy. Sounds extremely generous anyway. But Gulf Oil says that that's all right. Because the money is being made.
The gold will get the money.
Yeah. Yeah. And Gulf and Gulf says those are the arrangements. The stipulation is that Gulf will do all of the refining of that oil, including refining done in Angola. Now, money is made in the process basis of goods. What has happened in most arrangements in international trade is as follows. Richer countries import raw materials and make money on the processing, and they make money on the export. Good. All right? So often, tariffs, customs, quotas are used so as to discourage the industrial, the processing itself being done in countries that have those resources. I'll give you an example. Contract between companies in this country that process cocoa, which we don't have, they don't know, is regulated by U.S. tariff law that says if Ghana wants to send us cocoa, we will charge no tariff on raw cocoa. If Ghana wants to send us chocolate candy bars, there's a very high tariff. So Ghana doesn't make any money in the processing and exporting them as candy, chocolate candy. Ghana can break into our market by sending us chocolate.
Fine, that's a lot of tariff. Then we could be complaining about multinationals using the U.S. market and using all the markets. In fact, it could be a problem.
Yeah, okay, go ahead. People from North America will tell you. Okay, then I'm now going to give you another third world reply. In Tanzania, the Philips company, the Netherlands company that makes the radios and outboard cables and so on, large multinational corporations, had a plant. It turned out that the plant of the Rooster Tanzania had the second highest rating of all plants in the world for efficiency. Cheap labor, lots of folks in the labor pool, everybody wanted jobs, better paying jobs than can be found elsewhere. The cost of the radio that was produced in Tanzania was the same in Tanzania as it was in the United States. Because the multinational corporation looked at the world and set the prices for radio. So it wasn't any less expensive in Tanzania to buy that radio, even though it was produced at far less cost than it was here. It was just sort of rationalized the whole system.
Well,
so on Tanzanian wages,
that would be
a far more. What I'm saying is that you have raw materials and cheap labor, in classic economic theory, that's comparative advantage. It should be in the advantage of those countries to have raw materials and cheap labor. They ought to benefit from that. Then they can compete with countries like us where we pay high labor, et cetera. It turns out, however, whether it's by way of international trade or whether it's by way of multinational corporations, that there isn't a comparative advantage because they don't get cheaper radio. If that's the thing,
yeah, because they get the world price that radio is taking to produce more people.
Yeah.
If you plotted that in the times there, if you plotted that in the times in here, but it's going to go in the wrong and it's going to go all over the world.
But that would be the key then, would be the ocean, would be the get the sand together, because it could be the same way, because one of the companies wouldn't go down, wouldn't have children there, but if they get it all together and pass some regulations, you can talk it to them.
There are several things going on right now. One is to get agreed upon prices for major market commodities, export stocks. To say that, you know, for the next 5 years the price will not fall below such and such the cost. To guarantee some sort of stability in international price. That's the important in the so-called international economic order. Another thing is a code that regulates the activities of multinational corporations. And that's being worked on in the United Nations and elsewhere. There are lots of things happening.
But Tanzania, I mean, is that a really a good example? I mean, because the world has been taking a lot of low-cost producers. And China, which is 25% of the world population, now is committed to be the world's low-cost producer. You know, what price do you want? And I think, I don't know if you've noticed, but we have a hell of a lot of Chinese products coming to the United States. And, you know, wasn't China, that Japan a low-cost producer? Wasn't Korea?
Yeah.
Wasn't Taiwan? Yeah. I understand Brazil was.
Yeah.
So the Tanzanian case, it doesn't seem to me, Larry, to be all that typical as of late. The last 10 years. You know, I mean, I'm sure the displacement of certain circumstances, certain company policies, certain government policies, all these things that probably work to the disadvantage of Tanzanians, but I wouldn't think that that'd be, I mean, if they are low cost producers, they should be able to enter the world market in today's overall system.
The key development strategy has been that of export-led industrialization. Companies seek to industrialize in some quarters in order to export goods that then enter the international economic market. Benefits from that, you fall it back into your industrialization program. Several nations have benefited from that. You name several of them. One could add Taiwan, South Korea to that list, Singapore. Some others, we don't know for sure whether Brazil or Mexico, you know, if the poverty has increased or decreased. But the number of countries that have benefited by that strategy, compared to the number of poor nations, is very, very small. Secondly, the sectors which have benefited in those countries have been urban sectors. That's where Thirdly, within the urban sectors, only some groups have benefited. So you have, as in the Latin America, a massive amount around in the urban sector. But the chief problem is that the majority of the world's poor are in the countryside. As industrialization simply has not addressed the massive problem of rural poverty.
What we see it really is some of these countries that are accepting industrialization. For instance, in Panama, which is probably one of the more advanced countries in Latin America, and it's about to absorb the canal zone. They do not, and they also have, I believe, in Latin America, the highest per capita income. They do not have the capability of absorbing more industry. The canal zone is going to be a burden they cannot handle within the foreseeable future because they do not have the technical, and they're the right people, they do not have the technical base to run the country, the industry, and the canal zone simultaneously. You're going to have to import outside people who will be basically rejected by the indigenous people. You can't even go in there to help many of these countries. Brazil is probably the best qualified to accept help. To pick itself up. Panama cannot.
multinationals, I think, are going to change the whole face of most of our cities. In LA, for example, there were four tire companies until recently. Uniroyal, for example, Firestone, Goodyear, they're all closed. And one of our men is in charge of stockpiling tires for the city. The local factories made them. Now he said most of them come from South Korea. And I noticed something in Fortune magazine that I thought was quite interesting, because Fortune is pro-American industry. It said in the editorial that in France, for example, a decision is made about a movement, potential movement of the corporation. 50% of the decision revolves around the employees, because they built their homes, they stabilized their life around the corporation. And Fortune said that's not America. American policy is only the bottom line, 100%. Will it pay? So that many of our areas, for example, in LA, are 60% unemployed. Now, the first iron made in America were made in Ontario in 1904 by General Electric. The third generation is now being employed, father, son, and grandfather. And they're closing, making plastic irons overseas. And I see this happening more and more. There's a tremendous movement against unions. And what will come to, I suppose, the global village, where our economic level of living will have to be curtailed, because at our rate, corporations move like the wind. They move out of the labor union market to the south, and then 3-4 years they get tantalized by low-cost production overseas. But in our area, it's very evident, and of course it's devastating, because with the new movement toward cutting off support for the poor, in the ghettos of Los Angeles, it's really kind of frightening.
The automobile industry in particular, Ford Motor Company would have gone bankrupt. It was in, at least their domestic operations were in much more severe financial distress than the popular case we know about Chrysler. It was only their international operations that kept the company afloat. And you say, hey, this is great. They come out with this Fiesta, the world car, all these parts are interchangeable. That's fantastic. Well, if you go back and look at where all these parts are being produced, they're being produced in Korea, they're being produced in Taiwan, and in some places in South America, in particular Brazil. You know, you say, oh, this is great for the American economy. We'll have these great small cars, and Ford's doing wonderful. Well, you look at who's doing, I shouldn't say you look at who's doing wonderful, but when you look at the effect that it's really having on the American economy, it's not quite such a rosy picture. You know, I mean, and that's the Ford Motor Company, that's just one case. You brought up the other cases of the tire company. And happens all the time.
Well, is this really helping the economy in these other countries, though? I doubt that it really is. I don't think they're getting the benefit of
this. Some of them are.
The LA Times that even tourism is a tragedy in many poor countries, because the government and the rich provide facilities for the tourists. They hire a few people at a low wage. And it says that money that should go into developing industry and stuff that provides profits or jobs for everybody are being curtailed. And the funds that should be available now go for hotels. So that if you get rich, and if you, and then the laborers make a buck a day, yeah. Otherwise it drains potential, you know, money from the poor.
I read an article not too long ago written by a black leader within the United States, and he expressed a concern that we're so much involved with and concerned with world affairs and the third world and the poor all over the world. What about those of us in the South? And if you think of all the blacks and minorities who are unemployed for whatever reason within their own country,
yeah.
And here we are running all over the world trying to Americanize everybody. It seems like our way is the best way that we could enforce this or impose this upon other nations. that puts me agree with his thinking that we should be concerned with our own poor, and I think Britain is probably taking a real good look at their own situation. They're finding they have some real problems in Germany too. And I think we're going to be getting back into that if we're not careful.
I'd like to make a comment about when the car plant so forth. In Europe, where you know you can't easily lay somebody off and you can't easily change the plant. You know, the opposite side of the coin is that all of a sudden your business is down 50% and you have to keep the 50% that you want, would like to lay off or pay some indemnity. Or if it doesn't make sense to stay in a place, the tremendous amount of indemnity you must pay for you to keep it open, but it's not an economically viable thing. So sooner or later you pay for it. And the other thing is, one of the things that maybe we do have to lower our standard of living here to have the rest of the world, you know, bring their standard of living up. And that's just part of the overall world equation. And that has to happen. And then I'd like to make one more comment, too, that I think another big problem is that modern countries today, more than ever, are reluctant to give anybody real good technology or sell it as cheaply as they did in the past. Mm-hmm. There was a great movement of technology in the 50s and 60s.
Oh, Germany and Japan.
Well, the 5% royalty, forget it. And you never get it. And the other thing is that even if you think 5% is good, the law is going to be passed maybe the maximum 2.5%. That's necessary. So these countries aren't going to get technology very cheap. They're going to pay through the nose for it. That didn't happen. That wasn't the case 20 years ago.
That's fine, I suppose, because that's our most exportable, our most exportable product.
Right, it is. I think a lot of people, or a lot of people think that they didn't really get what the technology was worth. You know, and they were treated unfairly with it. And then it's the PA was from sound, against known technology. You know, that kind of thing. Yeah. But I know that there's a lot of reluctance to let technology go to third world countries. And that's a kind of one, kind of shopping the world for technology.
And then we'll have a real competitor, because they're not out of the dark wood. They're brilliant people with hundreds.
I would guess that that whole thing that Larry put on the board 10 years from now, that you're going to have a third category. You're going to have China to be part of it. And you're going to have third world.
Maybe that's
the worst. All
they need is the know-how.
Well, we've got Japan here. They're just all over the world looking for technology.
I wasn't quite to get a newspaper about a month or 6 weeks ago, quite sick of it, and then I used to get a letter written in a book. And I thought it was a very good program. And in dealing with unemployment, and giving an example of the Western government, how we deal with unemployment. At first, it's just in this, I know I'm from Germany, and I know that obviously it's this that the and unemployment is on the rise, and focus them on something like this over the other already big. We have always been 7 or 8% in this country. And I think they really get into action. The government has in the industry to really change the people of industries that have been died down or whatever are not needed anymore. And they put these people right back into the workforce. And why can't they be done here? And maybe unemployment is not such a big step here. I think that basically people want to work. I don't accept this idea that people love to take advantage of welfare. But I don't really know how true that is, but I always have an exception of that. No comment.
That's being done to some extent. Industries themselves are retraining people, and the government does retrain people.
They show some examples on the internet, and it looks pretty sad to me that people can have been out of work for 2 years, and you know.
We've got some of our employees, I think, they've been paying 4 times.
I think Holden Village is what you would call a microcosm of the problem we're talking about. We have an industry that came in, that developed an area, that due to circumstances, either from a little I know, the depletion of materials, the change in the market, the abandonment of a complete city, I don't know what happened to the miners, they're gone.
They left the food
in their ice box.
Another group comes in and is now using
this in a different way, with a different purpose.
Yeah.
And I wonder if there is an evolutionary process. that we are a part of,
yeah,
that that we require to manipulate. It doesn't seem that any of the discussion that we had tonight answered the question of the starving guy in Cambodia with the belly that's bloated and the ribs that are shown. We've talked about the economics and the reasons that we can't do something, but not necessarily the human, the pain, you know,
yeah,
the cry that's there.
Yeah.
I don't know that I can. I could give everything that I have to the poor right now, and I don't think it would make any difference.
But if you say that, part of the problem always, of course, is when you think of this kind of question, you're talking in really large terms, large dimensions, and so it looks futile in one sense of the term. But on the other hand, if you completely discount, you know, whatever it is that you give to the poor, then I think that really is kind of a sense of no hope or despair altogether.
There may be no hope, though, for ecological reasons. It may well be. Now, listen, I'm not a doomsayer.
No.
I'm an optimistic type, basically. But there is an ecological phenomenon that is never new to the world. First described by a man named Calhoun. And so we call it Calhoun's behavioral sink syndrome. Many of you have no doubt heard it. I'm a little surprised somebody hasn't brought it up. It would not matter, probably, how much, and that every surplus bit of food wherever in the world was distributed to the hungry, it would make probably no difference, because the fate factor for the human animal is very close to being violated on the globe as a whole. These things were first noticed in Bogota, Colombia, nearly 15 years ago, and strangely enough, the regular dental practitioner noticed a very peculiar phenomenon. Among the very poor moving in from the rural area, he saw a sick child. The child had running sores all over his body, laying in the gutter. The parents were sitting right there, and they looked reasonably healthy. I mean, they weren't really healthy like we are, but they weren't certainly a bad child. And this doctor felt moved to help the child. He knew he couldn't help the whole area, but he said to the parents, "Let me take this child to my clinic, a mile or so down the road." And the parents said, "What for? There's nothing wrong with the child. The child's fine. And, you know, here he said he could see over 100 sores on the kid right there. The kid's unconscious too. He couldn't wake him up." These parents insisted, in fact, about the third time he said, "Well, no, I really think this child is ill," the parents both got hysterical and started pounding on him and screaming, "This child is healthy. There's nothing wrong with our child. Go away." He went away. Well, this got studied fast, and to make a long story short, they noticed a lot of other things developing in this group of people. And since that time, these things have been noticed in Beijing. Now, China got a handle on this split. It is a very low level in Beijing and Shanghai, two cities in China where the food is on there. It's rampant in Los Angeles, rampant in Chicago, very bad in New Orleans, very bad in New York. It is at its worst in New Delhi, very bad in London, also bad in Moscow, and numerous other large cities. I could name a long list. The symptoms. Also, we really knew of this thing long ago among native animal populations. The famous rabbit die-off in Minnesota. The lemming that rushed to the ocean and drowned ever so often. These are showing behavioral symptoms too, because the numbers of them, even though they have enough food and there's no problem with starvation like they were the lemmings, they have exceeded an ecological space factor for that organism. And a certain number of them simply can't stand the stress of this. They suffer massive endocrine degeneration and madly rush out in case of lemmings to essentially self-destruction. Well, in these cities, in the last 15 years, there have been
And I don't know why this isn't put out more in the media. Maybe it's because it takes too long to explain it. I don't know. But there have been tens of thousands of deaths recorded wherein the autopsy noted massive endocrine degeneration. Now those are physical and physiological behavioral symptoms. What are behavioral symptoms, okay? There's tremendous increase in homosexualism, male and female. Now homosexualism is found in all animal populations, even crazy. Earthworms, well, they are hermaphrodite, although they fertilize each other, so that, you can't say that. The crayfish, yes. And all vertebrates show homosexualism, but at what we would call, you know, more or less normal level. So this is a symptom that increases tremendously under behavioral stress. Family disintegration. Whatever social organization may exist, rapid disintegration of that. Organisms that ordinarily would show some sort of recognition of each other, like say brother to brother, you know, like among prairie dogs, for example, no longer do. In fact, the minute they fight, and their fight no longer is a bluff, like it used to be, under normal conditions, a fight is a fight to the bloody death. Well, the ecological journals are full of this kind of stuff for human beings. And human beings in all the cities I mentioned are considered to have exceeded the space vector and that the globe itself within, like, I believe the last figure was like around the year 2020, would have exceeded the space vector for all of humanity. Now, I don't hear this problem addressed at all. To me, it makes all these others rather inconsequential.
So you're not saying that there's a goal, that there's something inevitable?
No, it's not inevitable, because as Larry pointed out, the birth rate is dropping. And also, there's another thing to bring in here. We're talking about a physical space factor, and it is possible, we found, through experimentation, to provide a mental space for someone, wherein we can shrink your physical space that is essential for your well-being. That takes some training, and I don't know if we want to do that way anyway.
Excuse me, but I lost out somewhere. Mm-hmm. Now, in the beginning of this thing with this child, what was the psychological, did they not want the child to live?
Who knows? They didn't
want... I mean, how did the child assume?
They said that they did not perceive their child being ill. That's all they could say. It's just they didn't perceive their child being ill.